In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's guest is the best-selling author and historian Dan Jones. Dan is best known for writing historical non-fiction about the Middle Ages, but he's recently turned his hand to writing a ghost story, using a medieval spooky tale as his template. Our content director, Dave Musgrove, caught up with Dan to find out more.
Dan, you've been prolific this year with your writing. Not only have you written a huge, wide-ranging history of medieval Europe with your Powers and Thrones book, which we've talked about on this podcast already, but you've also reimagined a famous medieval ghost story in another book you've written, The Tale of the Tailor and the Three Dead Kings. So this story you've retold, when and where was it first told?
So around the year 1400, a Cistercian monk in Byland Abbey collected a group of 12 stories of the supernatural that had been going on around the abbey that seemed to have been told by ordinary people of that part of the world. And they're written down on a single piece of vellum, parchment, in the back of a collection of manuscripts which are not about ghost stories at all, which are things like orations of Cicero and Christian theological tracts. So it's sort of like scribbled on these stories are kind of scribbled in this incredibly crabby hand, as it were, on the back of a napkin, and then remained in the library, first at the Abbey and then in the British Library, sort of untouched and largely ignored for more or less 600 years.
And we'll come to how they were rediscovered in a bit. But do we know anything about this the person who wrote these stories? Do we have a name for this monk, or is this just don't know anything about them?
This is just anonymous monk In Byland Abbey. Now, what we do know is a little bit about Byland Abbey, which is a Cistercian monastery in a great part of the world for Cistercian monasteries, that it had at one time been extremely grand, that by the year 1400 it was falling into some state of disrepair with not many brothers and not many people serving them. There was a rattling around in the place. But no, we don't know anything really about the person who actually wrote this stuff down.
And do we have any sense about why they were written down? Or who they were written for?
They seem to have been written down for a few reasons. One is that it's just weird. It's just good, weird stuff that's been happening locally. The stories, and most of them are very short. The Tale of the Tailor, as I've called it, is by some distance the longest, and it's not very long in its original form. In some cases, there are a couple of sentences. So clearly the person who wrote these stories down had an interest in the wacky, the weird, and the supernatural. The fact that they've been collected with texts like Cicero, texts by various Christian theologians, would suggest that they're there for a form of... there's a sort of didactic purpose. They seem to be some sort of teaching aid, so that alongside the sort of... the very formal things that are going to teach rhetoric, things that are going to teach theology. Here we have some sort of folk tales with which, if you can imagine teaching a group of bored young monks or men on their way to becoming fully professed monks, and they're rolling their eyes and finding it incredibly tiresome to sit through hour after hour of Latin rhetoric. You might just want to have in your back pocket something weird to pull out and entertain them. I mean, if you've ever been or had a good teacher, that's a sort of go-to trick. And I think that there's part of the purpose is that these are there to be drawn on as entertainment for recalcitrant students. But I think more probably there was just a sense that weird stuff was abounding, and whoever wrote them down just thought it would be fun to keep a track of it.
So you mentioned that the stories were kind of perhaps somewhat forgotten for centuries. How do we know about them now? Tell us about M.R. James, who he was and his involvement in this.
Well, almost exactly 100 years ago, M.R. James, best known for his ghost stories, best known today for his ghost stories, which have been adapted over the last 50 years numerous times for television, most recently by Mark Gatiss, who does one most Christmases. M.R. James was, in fact, in his day, and we're going back to the 1920s in this case, M.R. James was an extremely accomplished medievalist. He edited, I mean, I still use M.R. James's volume of Walter Map, you know, the waspish Welsh chronicler from the court of Henry II. He originally transcribed and edited that text. He'd been in charge of the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. He'd been provost of Eton College. He was a scholar at King's. He was an extremely accomplished medievalist, but he also had this interest in the supernatural. Now, in the year 1921, I think, M.R. James was working in the then British Museum with the collection that's now the core of the British Library, and a new catalogue came out of the manuscripts in the Royal Collection. And the catalogue mentioned in passing that this group of Byland Abbey manuscripts had some weird ghost stories in the back. So M.R. James had known that this was there, had heard about it from other scholars before, but was now prompted to go and take a look at these ghost stories. And he transcribed them in their medieval Latin, which he described somewhat dryly as very refreshing. It's extremely difficult and tortuous, in fact. He transcribed them, and they were published in the pages of the English Historical Review. Now, a couple of years later, in a local historical journal, they were then translated into English by a scholar called Grant. And they've been occasionally looked at by other scholars ever since, over the 100 years that have elapsed since the 1920s and now. But they're not very well known at all.
And so I thought I'd better... have a read of the original M.R. James article. I had a quick gander, and as you say, he describes the Latin as very refreshing. I had a look at the transcription. I thought my medieval Latin is not up to translating this anyway. So, but I did enjoy his little. You can see the sense of M.R. James in his footnotes. He talks about the ghosts do not twitter and squeak like those of Homer. And there's another point where he says, "This is most curious. Why did the woman catch the ghost and bring it indoors?" Which is so. There's some strange stuff going on in these stories. When you read them, when you look at them, what are these stories like? Are they well told? You said some of them very short. I mean, are these sorts of things that Stephen King would be proud of, or are we in a different category completely?
We're in a different category completely. I mean, they're fragmentary, they're partial, they're of like extremely just weird stuff happening that doesn't have a coherent beginning, middle, and end. There's no Hollywood story arc to most of these tales. But I think that may be why they appeal to M.R. James. Now, if you've ever read any of M.R. James's original ghost stories that he himself wrote, they do have this fragmentary, broken, shard-like character. If you think about, well, what's one of M.R. James's most famous ghost stories? A Whistle and I'll Come to You. You know, the story about the guy who goes up playing golf and finds a Templar and goes rooting around in a Templar preceptory, finds a whistle, blows it, and then this odd thing, a weird face in a window, and he feels like he's being kind of there's someone in his room at night, and he's all tangled up in his bed sheets. It's not really a proper, neat Stephen King style story, but it does more accurately reflect the, if you've ever had any experience with feeling something unnatural or haunting or supernatural, it does more accurately reflect the fleeting and inexplicable nature of that experience. M.R. James's stories reflect that, and I think that the tiny little shards of ghostly happenings in Yorkshire in around the turn of the 14th and 15th century, it's got that same essence to it.
So do we know, I mean, M.R. James obviously had a great interest in these sorts of stories, and from his own writings, he was clearly into this topic. And when you read that article that he wrote, the original one, he sort of talks about them reminding him of Danish folklore, I think. Now, you get kind of revenants and the like in Viking sagas, but I don't think that's what he's talking about, is it? I don't know. Do we know where this, what sort of context and tradition these medieval ghost stories sit in?
I think that, I mean, in some of the, he said Danish sagas, but I think it's slightly close to Icelandic sagas. I mean, there's a very famous Scandinavian ghost story in the course of a bigger chronicle, and the undead ghost is called Glam. I don't know if you know the story of Glam, and who's a real beast, a real monster. He dies and he then comes back to life, and he's capable of destroying houses and killing anyone who comes looking for him. And he sort of wanders into a much longer story and then just sort of disappears again. And so I suppose that some of that may be what M.R. James had in mind when he wrote that, that these tales, they don't really add up that well. And they do seem very rooted in the earth. These are not stories of, they're not like the Arthurian romances. They don't have this this questing or high chivalrous character to them. They're not in any way close to, for example, if we think about the supernatural beings who wander across Crétin de Troyes' stories. You know, if you think about Lancelot, the knight in the cart being driven by a sort of a dwarf, and by which I mean like an imp, an ogre, clearly a supernatural character within the story, but it's part of a much grander kind of quest, which these stories have nothing in common with that medieval literary tradition.
I guess when you talk about Arthurian tradition, then you know the Green Knight story,
which is being
turned into a Hollywood film as we speak. It's a very strange story that's hard to get your head around.
it's weird. It's definitely weird, and I'm very eager to see the Green Knight cinematic adaptation. But again, that's something much more elevated, more courtly, that engages with rules of chivalry, that engages with the ideas of questing. None of the stories from the Byland Abbey manuscript are anything like that. They're rooted in the soil, in the earth. They're like ordinary people going through just weird stuff when they're going about their ordinary business, walking from one place to another, and something comes out of the hedge and scares the hell out of them.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Now, all the time we lived in that house made some weird noises. That house creaked, and that house definitely felt weird when you went in the two oldest rooms. Possibly because I'd been told the story that it was haunted. Possibly, depending on how you approach these things, because it was haunted.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So the one that you've chosen to retell, so you've called it The Tale of the Tailor and the Three-Day King. It doesn't have a title, does it? There's no. You know, there's no titular bit on the manuscript. No. So that's from you. Was that the kind of the fullest story? Was that the one where you had the most material to go on?
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened was I went looking for a medieval ghost story first and foremost because it was Halloween 2020. And it was, were we locked down at that point? Not quite, or maybe just about to be. Or so it was bad times anyway. It was boring times. And trick-or-treating was off the menu. And I thought, I've got two girls. And I thought, I'll tell them a ghost story. And I went looking for a medieval one to try and triangulate between, try and slip a bit of knowledge in as I did so. And that's how I came across this M.R. James's original article about these stories. And I thought, right, and I went and I looked through them and I thought, well, the only one that's got enough substance for me to tell them that's not just like a ghost came and threw me over the hedge and that was that, was the second of these 12 Byland Abbey ghost stories. And it's by some distance the most fleshed out of the tales, which made it attractive. It has a central protagonist whose name is Snowball, who is a tailor. Probably his surname is Snowball. It involves him encountering several different ghosts, going off and having to do something, coming back once he's done it and encountering the ghosts again. And so that gives it a sort of a narrative shape that most of the other stories lack. And it's just quite weird. It's really weird. And so it struck me as the best one that I could tell the kids. And an M.R. James style, I sat down and in a session rewrote it, retold it. And I say M.R. James style because he used to write his own stories quickly, longhand. I didn't do it longhand, but he used to write them quickly and in one or two sessions. And then I had a story and I went to tell it to my kids and they couldn't have cared less. They were like, we're going to watch something on YouTube. We don't want that nonsense. So I sent it to my publisher instead.
So you've preempted my answer. So you've channeled your inner M.R. James. You've written the story in one go, and then you've sat down for a nice fireside chat with your kids, and they didn't go for it. They didn't think this medieval ghost story is going to hold their attention.
I don't know if you've ever read the stories of Molesworth.
No.
I read the Molesworth stories when I was growing up. Molesworth is a character by Willens and Searle. There were a series of short Molesworth novels, and Molesworth was a sort of send-up of English public school day stories, and the central character was Nigel Molesworth. Anyway, I tell you that only because there's a bit of Molesworth where his father sits him and his brother, known as Molesworth II, down at Christmas and attempts to read them the Christmas Dickens's A Christmas Carol. And it's the boy's worst bit of Christmas. They will do absolutely anything to avoid a dramatic telling of A Christmas Carol by their father, who wants nothing more than to spend Christmas Eve reading a scary ghost story to them. A similar effect was at play with my children. I mean, actually, I gave the manuscript of the story to my eldest daughter, who's now nearly 13, and she read it in her room where her reaction could not be observed or gauged. And I said, after a day or so, what do you think? She went, yes, fine. That's the sum total. I deeply hope for a more enthusiastic response on the part of the readers of The Tale of the Tailor and Three Dead Kings. But on the other hand, there's now a very low baseline. Like anything above sullen fine is great for me.
So we know what people need to write on their online reviews for this book. Yeah, it's fine. Would cover it. So not going too much into the tale of the story, because obviously we want people to go and have a read of it. But it's a very curious tale about this chap, Snowball, who encounters some ghosts, does some things, wanders along some lonely roads, has some fairly scary sounding experiences. You've had to elaborate, I guess, to make it into a story a bit. But there are some themes in it that sort of touch on wider understanding of sort of medieval attitudes in terms of purgatory, mass, and unburied bodies, because that's kind of some of the things. Give us a sense about what it tells us about medieval attitudes to death, I guess, a little bit.
Well, at the heart is a story about moving into the afterlife. It's a story that starts... So Snowball the tailor is riding his horse along the road, and he's picked on by some ghosts, and he's picked on because he hasn't heard mass that day. So he's picked on because he's already slipped from the Christian ideal. And the ghost or ghosts, which take various forms, eventually tell him that they are, it is the spirit of somebody who was known in the local area to be a terrible person and was considered damned when they died. And the soul is complaining that they are effectively in limbo, in purgatory, and can't move on into another realm of the afterlife unless Snowball helps them out, which he then goes off and does it, and comes back having done it. And the consequences of him having done it are ambiguous, let's say. So it's a story about redemption. It's a story about the afterlife. And as you pointed out, it's a story about medieval attitudes to death, which are that there were certain things that you had to do every day. There were certain important things that you had to do in your life or not do in your life if you wanted to pass into another world. It also shows us about the deep elision between, quote-unquote, or rather with a small o, orthodox medieval Christian belief and pagan ideas of the afterlife, and how these two things are really sort of woven together. It's not as simple as here's a tortured soul that is known to be in purgatory. You know, in the Middle Ages, it was people could work out where a soul was, or had a system for saying, I think we know where this particular soul is. I think it was Richard the Lionheart. Someone had worked out that because he'd paid for an awful lot of masses for his soul, his path through purgatory was going to be quite fast. And so on a certain date, about, I'll get the number wrong, but I think it's sort of 56 years after Richard the Lionheart died, there was a big celebration that it was like, Richard's got to heaven! He's made it through purgatory! It's got to be! It's like, it's to the day! We worked this out! Okay, so so that's a sort of fairly orthodox understanding of a soul's passage through purgatory. In these stories... And in this story, Tale of Taylor and Three Dead Kings in particular, you've got something that's much more kind of a messy combination of the soul can't move on because there are some things that it has to sign off in its sort of Christian duties. But on the other hand, it's taking the form of weird animal-type ghosts that are really nothing to do with scripture or recognized Christian tradition. So it's this really like messy kind of interesting mixture of folk belief and sort of higher Christian theology, I suppose.
And as you're saying, we think this is probably written sometime in the early 15th century, turn of the 15th century, 1400s. So that's quite a long time after Christianity had been embraced in Britain, in England. It's interesting that these folklore traditions still permeate, but I guess they still do today, don't they? Even though we're...
Although I think that the story of Christianity spread in England, Britain, but full stop in the West... is the story of it, it's finding compromise between local tradition and its own internal theology. If you think back to where our Christian, early Christian churches in England are often found near what had been pagan shrines in the countryside, right? And meetings of river and water sources in pre-Christian times. There's Christianity throughout the Middle Ages is traditionally quite or has periods where it's good at compromise. It's really, really good at compromise with folk beliefs. I mean, the obvious one that everyone trots out is, why is Christmas at Christmas? Because it coincides. Why is Easter at Easter? Because these important ritual dates in the Christian calendar are over time massaged towards times of older social celebration or communal coming together. So I think that's not that odd in the medieval context. And I think it's not odd in the modern context either. I mean, why are we giving out chocolate eggs with pictures of rabbits on them at Easter? You know, we still do exactly this thing. It's not Jesus on the front of your Cadbury's cream egg, is it? It's like a chick. That's compromise between these two festivals. And, did Jesus really want you to get a PlayStation 5 to celebrate his birth? I don't know. I don't think so. I'm not sure. I'm not qualified to say.
So
yet.
This might be sort of unknowable, but do we know what the medieval attitude to ghosts was? Were people sort of in fear of stepping out of their houses at night for fear of bumping into a ghost? Do we have much sense of what they might have thought about this sort of thing?
Well, I suppose I should say that. I'm just a dude who wrote a story in this context, right? And I know a little bit about the Middle Ages, but I'm not deeply expert on medieval ghosts. But from my amateurish understanding, and the number of times that I've sort of bumped into ghosts, as it were, in medieval chronicles, they just seem to be much as they are today, accepted as something that kind of can. You can get lucky/unlucky and come across a ghost. When I came across the story of which I've called The Tale of the Tailor, I was like, I know a ghost story from the Middle Ages. What is it? And I couldn't think. And I went Googling. And then I went through Catalyst, the library catalogue. And eventually I found this, but this wasn't what I was looking for. And I remembered later, I was looking for William of Newburgh's Chronicle, which mentions a revenant. Is that the right way to say it? Or Revenant, it is Revenant.
Revenant.
Like the Leo DiCaprio film. Yeah, The Walking Dead. It's often cited as a sort of a vampire-style story, that the dead had been rising from their graves and tormenting people. So my sense, whenever I've come across ghosts in the chronicles, as opposed to legends, is that much like now, you'll just get a ghost. And it's pretty weird. I grew up in a house. That's not the end of the story. I grew up in a house for about 10 years. When we moved into this house, the original part of the house had been 16th century little tiny farm cottage. And the old bit of the house had a chimney with a priest hole in it, right? And so the old house had been two rooms, one downstairs with a big fireplace and the chimney and the priest hole, one room upstairs, thatch roof. Over the time it had been extended, but that was the old bit of the house. When my parents bought this house, they were told by the people they bought it off, when we took it over 5 years ago or whatever, we had to unblock all of the 16th century bit of the house. The doors had been like banged, boarded up. And the previous owners to us but one had refused to go into that bit of the house because they were absolutely convinced it was haunted, potentially by the ghost of a priest. Now, all the time we lived in that house made some weird noises. That house creaked, and that house definitely felt weird when you went in the two oldest rooms. Possibly because I'd been told the story that it was haunted. Possibly, depending on how you approach these things, because it was haunted. There's no way of telling that you can't run a controlled experiment to see. However, that's struck me that that's a good example of you just kind of, sometimes you come across a place that's haunted. It just is. And I think in the Middle Ages, kind of similar.
Right. So finally, tell me this. So you've reimagined this story. You've rewritten it. You've mined what the monk wrote, and then you've put your own twist on it. Did you, in so doing, did you get any sort of further insight into the guy who wrote it? This, and I assume it's a guy. This anonymous, that's a tricky word. Anonymous monk from the 15th century. He seems like a bit of a gloomy sort to me. Maybe he wasn't. Did you kind of, through writing this, get any closer insight into the monk that actually penned the original tale?
It's quite hard. The sense I got from reading the quite short fragmentary bit of this story as it existed in the Byland Abbey Chronicle in the context of the other 11 stories that he'd written down was that he's not necessarily wide-eyed and credulous, but certainly bought into the existence of the afterlife, was a pragmatic believer in ghosts, let's say, did have a sort of gothic, small g, I think, interest in weird stuff, with which I can sympathise, wanted to illustrate through the stories the perils of impiety, wasn't a very good storyteller, fundamentally, was quite nervous about upsetting local people. The ghost who is tormented and who Snowball the Tailor has, so Snowball the Tailor is a named character, but the ghost who has to be sort of released from purgatory by Snowball the Tailor is never named. In fact, the name is deliberately sort of redacted in the original story, and I've kept that the same way in my telling of the story, because I suppose the reason might be that this is a sort of an eminent local personage, or that it's somebody whose name will be, to use the 21st century argot, triggering to those who hear the story. But so the monk is kind of very aware of not upsetting people, even when scribbling down stories not for public or wide public consumption. So he's obviously either a coward or quite sensitive to local interests, depending how you look at it. Beyond that, it's somewhat hard to say. And in the process of writing what is, I suppose, essentially fiction, which is different from writing non-fiction, I discovered, you, of course, then put the stamp of your own preoccupations on the story. So this story has a lot of my fictional style to it. That tries to tease out the gloominess that you've recognised in the original, but overlays it with another sort of, with a gothic vision that I'm developing in other fiction that I'm writing at the moment.
And do you have high hopes for the movie rights on this one?
Enormously high, yeah. Yeah, just as soon as I call Mark Gatiss. It'll be on your screens about never. I don't know. Who knows? It's quite a good story. It's got an M.R. James connection. And if I was commissioning a film at the BBC to be shown at Christmas that had a little medieval twist and an amusing horse, we haven't even talked about the amusing horse, I'd plump for the tale of the tailor in Three Dead Kings.
I've deliberately not talked about The Amusing Horse because I thought maybe our listeners might want to pick up the story themselves. But there is a strange horse in it, I would agree. Which refers back to our previous podcast conversation about the Great Stirrup Controversy, which if any listeners want to refer back to our conversation on Powers and Thrones, then we talk about that there. So if you want a medieval ghost story, The Tale of the Tailor and the Three Dead Kings by Dan Jones is out now. Dan, thank you very much for your time once more.
Thank you.
That was Dan Jones. His ghost story, The Tale of the Tailor and the Three Dead Kings, is out now, published by Head of Zeus. Dan's most recent non-fiction book, Powers and Thrones, is also available now. And the podcast that was mentioned where Dan and Dave spoke about Powers and Thrones is available in our archive at historyextra.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us again tomorrow when Professor Joyce Tildesley will be answering your questions about Egyptian pharaohs.